our regions, and I would invite you to stay tuned for All Things Considered.
We all remember the mistakes of Iran, and we have learned those lessons.
How the rest of the world is reacting to the American and Israeli war in Iran.
It's Tuesday, March 3rd, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. Ahead, when the federal government detains pregnant minors and its immigration raids, it sends them to a facility in Texas.
We will look at the possible reasoning behind the decision.
Federal government officials deny girls access to abortions. All they have to do is send them to Texas.
And what a study in the Ugandan rainforest tells us about when humans and our evolutionary cousins first became drawn to alcohol.
And how exactly scientists are coming about those findings.
The most consistent, predictable time is in the morning. Just like people, the first thing they do when they wake up is they go pee.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. As the war in Iran continues for a fourth day, the death toll for U.S. forces is rising. The Pentagon says six service members have been killed. Meanwhile, President Trump's reasons for attacking Iran continue to shift. NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports he now says it was proactive.
Trump had previously said that the U.S. acted in Iran because Tehran's nuclear program was close to having missiles that could reach the U.S. Now he says he believed an Iranian attack was coming first, though he did not cite any intelligence to that effect.
It was my opinion that they were going to attack first. They were going to attack. If we didn't do it, they were going to attack first. I felt strongly about that.
The U.S. struck Iran over the weekend after weeks of building up a large military presence in the region, even as negotiations to try to reach a deal with Iran were ongoing. Trump touted the success of the mission thus far, though he has not outlined how he sees the conflict ending, but he did say that, quote, lots of people are coming forward to negotiate a resolution. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News, The White House.
Today's the last day of voting for primary contests in Texas and North Carolina. Both states have expensive and closely watched Senate races. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
Democrats face long odds in regaining a majority in the U.S. Senate, but both North Carolina and Texas are states the party is eyeing as potential pickups later this fall. In Texas, Republican incumbent John Cornyn faces a challenge to his reelection from the state's often embattled Attorney General Ken Paxton and Congressman Wesley Hunt. Congresswoman Jasmine Crockett and James Tallarico are vying for the Democratic nomination. In North Carolina, there are contests for an open seat currently held by Tom Tillis, who announced his resignation last year. The state's former governor, Democrat Ray Cooper, is the front runner for the Democratic ticket, and former RNC chair Michael Whatley is favored to win the Republican nomination. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
Voters in Arkansas are also holding primary elections today. World oil prices rose once again today as the war with Iran weighs on energy and financial markets. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Shipping traffic through the Strait of Hormuz south of Iran has come to a virtual standstill. About 20% of the world's oil typically flows through that narrow waterway. Gasoline prices have also jumped, topping $3 a gallon for the first time since early December. The more people have to spend on gasoline, the less they have to spend on everything else. Fears of a consumer slowdown are weighing on the broader stock market. Natural gas prices have also jumped, which will raise both heating and electricity costs. Even before the war started, natural gas prices had climbed nearly 10% over the last year, and electricity prices have been rising at more than twice the rate of inflation. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Wall Street lower by the close, the Dow down 403 points. You're listening to NPR News. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick has agreed to testify before the Republican-led House Oversight Committee over his ties to the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. At a Senate hearing last month, he acknowledged visiting Epstein's Island in 2012 after saying he ended their relationship after Epstein was convicted of soliciting an underage prostitute. The information came to light in the Justice Department's latest release of Epstein files. No date for the testimony has been announced. Retail giant Target is once again reporting sluggish sales as its new CEO lays out plans to invest millions of dollars in updates to its stores, hoping to draw back shoppers. NPR's Alina Selyuk has more.
For 3 years now, Target has reported flat or falling sales each quarter, this time down 2.5%. Here's Kara Sylvester, Chief Merchandising Officer, addressing investors.
Our performance over the last few years has not met expectations, and that is on us.
But Target is projecting a better year ahead with growing profits and more shoppers visiting. The chain's new CEO, Michael Fiddelke, is not an outsider, but a longtime company executive. And so far, he's laid off hundreds of corporate staff to streamline the ranks. And he plans to spend $5 billion to overhaul Target's operations, especially stores. Executives are promising sharper designs, trendier selections, and attractive prices. Alina Seluch, NPR News.
And on Wall Street, the Dow was down 403 points today after being down around 1,200 points earlier in the day. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's 4:06. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Our weather for tonight, mostly cloudy, temperatures in the low 20s to low 30s. And tomorrow, patchy fog early, then partly to mostly sunny, highs 45 to 53. Winds from the southwest, 5 to 10, gusting up to 20. Lows tomorrow night in the mid to upper 20s. And Thursday, mostly cloudy with highs in the 40s. Breezy southeast wind. More news is next on KAXE.
Is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The U.S. and Israeli war on Iran is straining relations with some U.S. allies. Tonight, France's president said the U.S. and Israel are acting outside international law. Germany's chancellor happened to be at the White House earlier in the day. President Trump gave Friedrich Merz a warm welcome, but he had some harsh words for other European countries.
Spain has been very uncooperative. And so has UK.
We're going to talk about this now with two NPR international correspondents, Rob Schmitz in Berlin and Lauren Freyer in London. Hey to both of you.
Hi there.
Hello.
Rob, I'm going to start with you. Chancellor Merz was on a pre-scheduled official visit to the White House today, meeting President Trump. What did they talk about?
Yeah, President Trump said a lot of nice things about Merz. He called Merz successful. He said he was popular. He said the U.S. has been able to do deals with Germany. Merz spoke to reporters afterwards in English, and he said that Germany and the U.S. are on the same page in doing away with what he called a, quote, terrible regime in Iran. And he also said he and Trump need to talk about what happens when the regime in Tehran is out of power. Merz mentioned that the conflict has caused a bit of economic chaos for Europe. Here's what he said.
This is true for the oil prices, and this is true for the gas prices as well. So that's the reason why we all hope that this war will come to an end as soon as possible, and we are hoping that the Israeli and the American army are doing the right things to bring this to an end.
Rob, how does what Merz said today square with what he has said in the past when it comes to the transatlantic relationship?
Yeah, the tone has changed a little. You know, 2 weeks ago at the Munich Security Conference, I watched Chancellor Merz deliver a speech where he declared the international rules-based order dead. And he said this new order of what he called big power politics, engineered by the Trump administration, Russia, and China, was the new reality. And he called on Europe to unite so that democracy could survive. He characterized these big powers as sort of international bullies. But now that the U.S. and Israel have attacked Iran, Merz is signaling support for the U.S. in this endeavor. So it's a bit of a reversal for Merz.
Lauren, is it fair to say there was a bit of a reversal in the United Kingdom as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So the UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer initially said he would not allow the US to use British military bases to attack Iran. Spain said that too, prompting that retort from Trump you heard there. But then after the US and Israel launched their war and Iran retaliated against British allies in the Gulf, Starmer reversed himself. And so now he is allowing the US to use British bases, but only in what he calls a defensive way.
But what does that mean? Is the UK joining the war effort?
It's kind of a matter of perspective. Like, the UK is sending a warship to protect its airbase in Cyprus, which was hit by an Iranian drone. Starmer's critics accuse him of dragging the country into what they call an illegal war. One MP called Starmer Trump's poodle. That is what critics, you'll recall, mm-hmm. said about Tony Blair way back in 2003 when he joined the US-led Iraq war. They called him George W. Bush's poodle. But others compare this moment to a famous scene from a movie 2 decades ago. The film's called Love Actually. It's when a fictional prime minister played by Hugh Grant stands up to a bullying American president. And Starmer made this impassioned speech in Parliament saying Britain doesn't believe in, quote, regime change from the skies. And he also said this.
We all remember the mistakes of Iraq, and we have learned those lessons.
You know, Starmer does not want to be Tony Blair, whose legacy was really damaged by that Iraq war decision. Hundreds of thousands of people were killed in that Iraq war, including about 180 British military personnel. But all of this has left Trump very unhappy with Starmer right now.
Just like President Billy Bob Thornton was very unhappy with Prime Minister Hugh Grant. But let's talk more about reality. Why is Trump not happy with Starmer?
He went on a tirade in the Oval Office today against the United Kingdom, and here's part of what Trump said.
This is not the age of Churchill. I will say the UK has been very, very uncooperative.
So Trump there saying Starmer is no Churchill. That's Winston Churchill, the famous World War II British Prime Minister. Incidentally, I recently interviewed Churchill's grandson a few days ago. He is a veteran UK politician himself. He accuses Trump of destabilizing the US-UK special relationship, that longtime alliance. And he told me his granddad would not have liked Trump. It's worth noting that Starmer has really courted Trump. I mean, he's not one to criticize Trump normally. But Starmer is also looking domestically, and polls show that many, many more Britons oppose U.S. military action against Iran than support it.
Lastly, Rob, I'm going to go back to you. We heard what German leadership is saying about this. How do Germans themselves view this war?
Yeah, a poll by National Broadcaster over the weekend showed 59% of Germans do not support these attacks by the U.S. and Israel on Iran. Lauren mentioned how unpopular the Iraq war was in the U.K. I mean, it was also really unpopular among Germans. And in many ways, Germany has had to deal with the destabilizing consequences of that war, which over the next decade led to instability throughout the Middle East and then morphed into the Arab Spring. More than 1 million migrants from the Middle East eventually ended up seeking refuge in Germany. And this, in turn, helped fuel the rise of the far right here. Merz himself warned this past weekend that a war in Iran could turn into what he called an Afghanistan or Iraq-style quagmire that would have a profound impact on Europe. And he's talking about Europe bracing for yet another wave of migrants, except this time from Iran. And there is no longer as much tolerance for that scenario among Germany's political parties.
That is NPR's Berlin correspondent Rob Schmitz and London correspondent Lauren Freyer. Thanks so much to both of you.
You're welcome.
Since last July, the Trump administration has been detaining unaccompanied migrant girls who are pregnant in one shelter in South Texas. Some of the government's own health and child welfare officials object to this. They say neither the facility nor the region can provide the specialized care the girls need. Advocates for the children also say the government is knowingly putting the girls at risk to deny them access to abortions. The administration says it's just doing what's best for them. The California and Texas newsrooms have been investigating this story, and Mark Betancourt is the lead reporter. He joins us now. Hi there.
Hi, Juana.
Mark, let's just start off with these girls. They're being detained in just one shelter. Is that normal?
No. Usually pregnant kids who get picked up by immigration authorities without a parent or guardian are spread out in shelters or foster homes around the country. But we spoke with 7 people who work at the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or ORR. That's the federal agency that has custody of these kids. These sources asked not to be named because they're afraid of retaliation. But they said in late July, the acting head of ORR, Angie Salazar, ordered the agency to start sending all pregnant kids to this one shelter in San Benito, Texas, near the border with Mexico. And they say that's highly unusual.
Why unusual? What is the issue with putting them all in one place?
Well, this is not a medical facility. It's a group home. So it's not a place you'd want to put lots of people who could need special medical care. Our sources say there haven't been any major medical problems so far. But my reporting partner, Mose Bouchel, and I spoke to several doctors who all say the younger the girl, the higher risk to the pregnancy. And some of the dozen or so girls sent to this shelter so far are as young as 13. Mm. At least half of them are pregnant because they've been raped. For many of these girls, there's also the stress of the journey to the U.S., including poor nutrition and little or no prenatal care.
And are they more at risk at the Texas shelter than they would be somewhere else?
Yes. So for starters, the health experts we spoke with said the region doesn't have enough of the specialized care these girls could need, especially in emergencies. Annie Leone is a nurse midwife who has worked with migrant girls in South Texas. She pointed out that the state's approach to health care, in particular its abortion ban, has limited obstetric care there.
It's not good to be a pregnant person in Texas. So to put this community in Texas and then in one of the worst healthcare regions of Texas is not good.
And several of the people inside ORR told us the shelter itself is not set up to handle many pregnant kids all at once.
How so?
Well, they said the shelter was barred from housing pregnant girls from September to December of 2024 because it wasn't providing proper medical care. That's part of why officials within ORR have been telling their leadership not to send pregnant kids there. The government contractor that runs this facility, it's called Urban Strategies, didn't answer our questions, but referred us to ORR.
And what did you hear from ORR?
Emily Hilliard from the Department of Health and Human Services, which oversees ORR, said that, quote, placement decisions follow child welfare best practices. Hilliard also pointed out that the Biden administration sent more than 100 pregnant girls to this shelter over its 4 years. But a former ORR official under Biden, Jen Smyers, told me that's comparing apples to oranges. There were way more kids in federal custody then, so the agency sometimes didn't have a choice where to place them. Also now, kids stay in ORR custody for much longer, so there's more time for medical problems to come up.
So then, why is the government doing this?
I asked current and former ORR officials, advocates, attorneys, child welfare specialists. None of them knew why the administration would choose to put all the pregnant girls in one place and at this shelter in Texas, given that their own experts are telling them not to. But all these sources who know this system are convinced the kids are being sent to Texas so they won't have access to abortion. Here's Jonathan White, who ran the agency's unaccompanied children program during the first Trump administration.
It's an effortless way to have federal government officials deny girls a right to access to abortions. All they have to do is send them to Texas.
I mean, that's a very strong assertion. Walk us through the thinking on that.
Well, they're not just looking at the order to send kids to this shelter. They're also looking at everything else the administration is doing. Current regulations say that if an unaccompanied minor requests an abortion and they're in a state like Texas where it's almost totally banned, ORR has to move them to a state where it's available. But now the administration is saying that taxpayer money shouldn't be spent on facilitating abortions, so ORR is in the process of rescinding that rule. The details of this rule change are still under review, so they're not yet public. But our sources worry that once pregnant kids are detained in Texas, ORR won't be able to move them out of Texas to get an abortion. We asked HHS specifically if that's the goal. The department told me that's, quote, completely inaccurate.
That's Mark Betancourt with the California Newsroom. He co-reported this story with the Texas Newsroom's Mose Bouchel. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, our daily dose of phonology, John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this date. Support comes from Paperstorm, providing on-site paper shredding services to commercial and residential customers throughout central and northern Minnesota. Accepting old paperwork during tax season with secure shredding services. More information at paperstorm.net. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, March 3rd, 2003, I see a flock of white-winged crossbills. The crossbills are interesting birds in that they nest whenever they feel like it. They have no common nesting time. They simply nest when the food supplies are good. And the crossbill, whose beak does not meet at the ends, is uniquely suited to the spruce tree. And when the crossbill is in the area, there will be large flocks up in the tops of the spruce. They land on the spruce tree. They bite into the bract in the cone. And that crossbill forces the bract open, and they can just drop their tongue in there and lick out the seed, which is their major source of food in the area.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Juana Summers. The Jewish holiday of Purim is celebrated today. It's centered around a biblical story set in ancient Persia, that is, modern-day Iran. As NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Israel, the holiday is resonating differently with the country at war with Iran.
At a small gathering in a top-floor Tel Aviv apartment, the biblical Book of Esther is recited in Hebrew from a parchment scroll. It's the holiday of Purim. The tradition is to boo and make noise when the villain's name is read. The villain of this biblical story is Haman, the advisor to the Persian king who plots to kill the Jews of the empire. The plan is foiled, and the enemy is killed. Rabbi Adi Elefant is hosting the holiday party. He's an Orthodox rabbi from the Hasidic religious movement Chabad. He raises his glass to me and toasts to life.
Hi.
So how is this holiday, Purim, different from any other?
Yeah, you're really asking? Everything happened then, happened now.
He compares the villain of the Bible story, Haman, to the Iranian supreme leader, whom the Israeli military killed on Saturday, Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath.
The one the military killed in Shabbat, Khamenei. It's the same name. Haman Aminahi is the same name. And they both want to do the same thing. They want to kill Jews around the world.
Israel considers Iran its arch enemy. The Islamic Republic's leaders have chanted death to Israel for decades. The rabbi says Khamenei's death has given him another reason to celebrate.
From Shabbat, I'm in heaven. I was waiting for this all my life.
On Saturday, an Iranian missile fell just a few blocks away from the rabbi's home, killing a woman. As missile fire continues, Purim holiday parties are officially canceled. But the war hasn't stopped many Israelis from still partying. They're just taking their parties underground. Into bomb shelters, like this dance party with a DJ captured on social media. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu also referenced the holiday at the start of the war. In ancient Persia, Netanyahu said in a video address, an enemy rose against us and was taken down. He said now, like then, Iran's evil regime will come to an end. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Hamnet is one of the films nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards. It is a fictionalized story about how William Shakespeare was inspired to write his masterpiece, Hamlet.
Tell me a story.
What story would you like?
Something that moves you.
It took a special kind of director to tell this moving story, Chloe Zhao. She is nominated for a Best Director Oscar and could become the first woman to win the award more than once. NPR's Medley DeBarco talked with her about her filmmaking process.
Chloe Zhao says she believes in ceremonies and rituals, in setting an intention, a mood, a vibration for any event. Before Hamnet premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival last year, she led the audience in a somatic exercise.
Breathe in and sigh.
Zhao also likes to loosen up, like she did at a screening of Hamnet in L.A. last month when she asked the audience to dance with her. Zhao often had dance parties during her film production. So for our NPR photo shoot and interview at a hotel in Beverly Hills, I invited her to share her playlist.
Gorgeous.
Then we sat down to talk.
I had a dream that we were doing this interview, and it started with a photo shoot, and there was a glass globe.
No way.
Yeah.
It so happens that on the desk next to us was a small glass globe, perhaps a paperweight.
Well, the me and the globe and the lights on the wall, they're all part of you. They're your inner crystal ball.
Dreams and symbols are very much a part of Chloe Zhao's approach to filmmaking, which she describes as a magical and communal experience. It's all part of her directing style.
If you're a captain of any ship, you are not just giving instructions. People are also looking to you energetically as well. Whether it's calmness, it's groundedness, it's feeling safe, then everyone else is going to tune to you.
Zhao says it's taken many years to get to this awareness. Her own journey began 43 years ago in Beijing, where she was born. She moved to the U.S. as a teen and studied film at NYU. Spike Lee was one of her teachers. She continued honing her craft at the Sundance Institute Labs, along with her friend Ryan Coogler and other indie filmmakers. Over the years, Zhao's film catalog has been eclectic, from her indie debut set on a Lakota Sioux reservation to a big-budget Marvel superhero movie. She got her first Best Director Oscar in 2021 for the Best Picture winner Nomadland. Next up is a reboot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
A creative life is not a linear experience for me.
For now, she lingers over making Hamnet, a very emotional story about the death of a child. During the production, Zhao says she used somatic and tantric exercises and rituals during shooting days, and she invited her lead actors, Paul Mescal and Jesse Buckley, to help her set the mood on set. They danced, they painted, they meditated together.
She created an atmosphere where everybody who chose to step in to tell this story was there for a reason that was deeply within them.
Jesse Buckley is nominated for Best Actress at the Oscars. She says to prepare for her very intense role as William Shakespeare's wife, Zhao asked her to journal her dreams.
As a kind of access point to gently stir the waters of where I was feeling. And I'd also send her a piece of music that I also felt was a tone and texture of that essence. And that kind of became the ritual of how we worked together. And not just the cast were moving together, but the crew were and the camera was, and really creating dynamics and a collective unconscious.
This was useful for creating Hamnet, a story about communal grief. Zhao says it took 5 years and a midlife crisis for her to develop the emotional tool she used to make Hamnet.
And I hope it could give people a 2-hour little ceremony. And in the end, I hope that a point of contact can be made. That means like there's a heart opening, but it'll be painful, right? Because when your heart opens, you feel all the things you usually don't feel. And then a catharsis that can help them to emerge.
I learned that everyone on Hamnet, from the casting director to the actors to the crew, seemed in tune with Zhao's MO. As our interview time came to a close, I had a request.
I have my own little ritual at the end of my interviews. I have to record the room tone.
Room tone, the ambient sound of the space we're in. It's for production purposes, to smooth out the audio. Zhao knew just what I meant.
You know, on Nomadland, my sound recordist, Oof, he said to me, I don't always need it, but just so you know, I am going to watch you. And when I tell that you are a little frazzled, I'm going to ask for room tone. Everyone just like, yeah.
A moment of silence and peace for director Chloe Zhao. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It's 4:29. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Hug Hydronics, committed to making in-floor heating simple, providing in-floor heating solutions for both commercial and residential. More information at hughydronics.com. Mostly cloudy tonight, temperatures ranging from the low 20s to the low 30s, and tomorrow patchy fog early, then partly to mostly sunny, highs 45 to 53. Winds from the southwest up to 20 miles per hour. Lows tomorrow night in the mid to upper 20s, and Thursday mostly cloudy, highs in the 40s. You can get a head start on spring cleaning with KAXE's Cars program. Your unwanted vehicle will be towed away for free, and the proceeds fuel all your favorite programs. It's quick, easy, there's no cost to you. Visit kaxe.org/cars to get started.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Little Bighorn, which is also called the Battle of the Greasy Grass or Custer's Last Stand. Ahead of events planned in late June near Crow Agency, Montana, are reports that the National Park Service is removing signs sharing the Native perspective on the battle. Brian Bull of Buffalo's Fire reports.
In late January, the Washington Post reported that President Trump ordered the removal of signage through his so-called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History directive, which pushes an ideology that the U.S. has a, quote, unmatched record of advancing liberty, prosperity, and human flourishing. The Battle of Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument is on the list of sites. Wallace Bairchum is chairman for the Northern Cheyenne Cultural Commission. Along with the Lakota Sioux and Arapaho, his tribe defeated Lieutenant Colonel George Armstrong Custer and the 7th Cavalry Regiment in 1876. Bairchum says federal officials and tribes need to discuss any changes per their government-to-government relationship.
We're still finding out what exactly changes that they're going to make. And the Northern Cheyenne, it was a victory for us there. And our stories there, I mean, how can you change that story? You know, there's no way you can do that, you know. And what exactly are they trying to change?
The Northern Cheyenne tribe unanimously approved a resolution last month to prevent any changes to markers, signage, and monuments that recognize Native people at Little Bighorn, a direct challenge to the Trump administration. Meanwhile, an email from the U.S. Secretary of the Interior's office denies any signage has been taken down at the battlefield monument. It says parks are complying through an ongoing review process with subject matter experts, tribal partners, and park leadership. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
An Alaska doctor has documented the first case of a rare and potentially risky infection from contact with a brown bear. The infection is known as seal finger, and people typically get it handling seals, especially during hunting and processing. But in 2024, Dr. Benjamin Wesley diagnosed it in a man who had cut his hand skinning a brown bear hunted on the Alaska Peninsula. He had 3 days of redness and painful swelling that did not resolve with standard antibiotics. Wesley says early tests did not find anything definitive, so he sent a tissue sample to a lab for more comprehensive analysis.
What was particularly shocking about this patient was he had a finger infection after skinning a brown bear that was not responding properly to antibiotics. So I sent special PCR tests, but I did not expect this bacteria.
Seal finger is not uncommon in Alaska and circumpolar regions, but Wesley says this is only the second time this potentially more serious strain of the infection has been identified in the state. He diagnosed the first case, too, in a patient whose finger infection had spread to his hip.
So when the report came back, I was shocked because the first case was my own patient 10 years prior, and now it was the exact same bacteria for the second time in Alaska, but from a brown bear exposure, not from a seal exposure.
The infection is only a risk through direct or indirect animal contact. Other cases outside the state have been tied to a polar bear and a domestic cat. Scientists do not know if those animals caused seal finger because they'd had contact with a seal or through other means. In this case, the patient was treated at first with the wrong type of antibiotics used for bacterial infections. That allowed the infection to worsen and cause dead tissue, a damaged tendon, and a bone infection. He recovered but still has lingering finger stiffness. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
We'll be right back.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Tribal Development Partners, supporting tribal sovereignty through 105L leasing and essential infrastructure development. Tribal Development Partners will attend Res 2026 in Booth 303 and are proud to support this show.
Hear that? Tribal college faculty do so much, one can't say it all here. Nothing but respect. Visit mosttheorjobdescription.com. The American Indian College Fund supports this program.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, RWJF is a national philanthropy working toward a future where health is no longer a privilege, but a right. Learn more at rwjf.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Iran's Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is dead. Whether the regime he led survives may depend on what happens in the coming days and weeks. In particular, one question: who will take his place and lead it? For a look at how the succession process plays out in Iran, I am joined by Mehrzad Bouroujerdi, an Iran scholar at the Missouri University of Science and Technology. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Let's start, just so we can understand how this would work in normal times. In Iran, citizens vote in elections for parliament and president, but ultimately power rests with the supreme leader. How is the supreme leader normally chosen?
Right. So the supreme leader is the focal point of Iranian politics, and theoretically, based on the constitution, he is supposed to be approved by an 88-member of Assembly of Religious Experts. And these are mainly sort of elderly folks in Iran. The joke in Iran is when you ask what is the average age of members of religious experts, people say deceased. The oldest member of that council presently is 98 years old. These folks are supposed to be deciding who the next supreme leader is. Just this morning, we got news that Israeli and American bombs have destroyed the headquarters of this assembly in the holy city of Qom. So we are not quite clear as to how this assembly is going to meet. Would they be voting online? Whether Ayatollah Khamenei had made any recommendation to them that was not made public. Mm-hmm. So this is really the most serious crisis of succession, considering the fact that they have to make a decision during wartime with this type of challenges in front of them.
Many of them seem to be being targeted by U.S. and Israeli military action. So it seems like the basic premise here of getting together to talk and meet seems incredibly difficult.
Correct.
We've been talking about the Assembly of Experts. I want to talk about another power setter in Iran, and that is the Revolutionary Guard Corps. What are you seeing? What are you thinking about what their role is in this moment, given this massive power vacuum and given the instability in the country?
Yes. So the Revolutionary Guards really is the body that must deal with any potential unrest sparked by Ayatollah Khamenei's death, the whole succession interlude that we are witnessing right now, and any eventual consolidation that must take place. This is assuming that the regime survives. This is also the body that is going to be losing the most. There is a phenomenon of officers' economy in Iran. These folks have benefited handsomely from sanction busting. And so the question right now is that how will they deal with the next supreme leader chosen by that assembly of experts? Will they exercise veto power if whoever is chosen is not to their liking? Or if this person is chosen, will they really maintain agenda-setting power and basically telling an unexperienced newbie how he should be conducting himself as the next supreme leader? So yes, IRGC, or the Revolutionary Guard, is really the force to look at this critical moment.
What do we know about the most likely contenders for the role of supreme leader, and what do we need to know about them in terms of, what their leadership could mean for the future of Iran?
Right. So, again, because of the opaque process of selecting a leader, you know, this is all a guessing on our part. I will mention three individuals that are on my radar. One is, of course, the son of Ayatollah Khamenei, who, you know, is sort of the ultimate insider for the job, but he has not really held any type of official elected or appointed offices. And because of his junior standing in the clerical hierarchy, his selection will also rattle the rank and files of the clerical and political class. The second individual is a member who was very much favored by Ayatollah Khamenei by the name of Ali Reza Erafi. This guy was given, entrusted with important positions, including being in charge of all the religious seminaries in the country, which is, of course, a rather important political and clerical task. Mm-hmm. He is also currently a member of that three-member council that are supposed to be taking care of issues confronting the country until the next supreme leader is chosen. And finally, I would say a former head of the judiciary, a gentleman by the name Ayatollah Sadegh Larijani. He comes from a well-established family, and therefore his brother also currently is the national security advisor. So he has, you know, the sort of the pedigree in terms of his religious standing, etc., and family connections, ties to the clerical establishment that might make him a suitable candidate.
You said at one point, if the regime survives, there is this tremendous military pressure being put on Iran right now. Walk us through what it would take for the regime to actually collapse in Iran.
Yeah, I think, you know, we need to keep in mind that Iran really was not a one-bullet state. We see that even after the demise of the supreme leader and many of the high military officials, the country is still continuing. They are firing missiles, etc. Law and order is still more or less there, and it hasn't collapsed yet. I think we have to keep in mind that for a regime to collapse, you need to have a serious, you know, opposition force that is able to play the role of a, you know, rival government and take over, etc. At this moment, as we speak, there is really no organized opposition inside the country. No part of the Iranian territory is under the control of an opposition force. And even though there is general popular discontent, this is not organized or sustained opposition. It has been very episodic over the last 40 years.
That's interesting. For all of the widespread protests that we have seen rise up again and again, a clear opposition group has not been able to form.
That's right. You know, the son of the former Shah, has a lot of sympathy both outside and, you know, inside the country. He has, of course, a symbolic capital as the inheritor of that thousands of years of monarchy in Iran. But at least so far, we have not really seen that he has the organizational muscle to be able to change the facts on the ground or try to unify the opposition. So that seems to be a liability. Furthermore, there are concerns as to whether we might see more or less a repeat of the Venezuelan scenario, meaning the Trump administration reaching to one of those members of the Revolutionary Guards, etc., and trying to come to terms rather than see the country really go into a chaos, considering that it's a country of 90 million people and geographically larger than Iraq and Afghanistan combined.
That is Mehrzad Borujerdi, the co-author of Post-Revolutionary Iran, a Political Handbook, and Vice Provost and Dean of the College of Arts, Sciences, and Education at Missouri S&T. Thank you so much for helping us understand all of this.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:44. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, stories from throughout the state of Minnesota. Mostly cloudy tonight, temperatures ranging from the low 20s to low 30s, and patchy fog early tomorrow with partly to mostly sunny skies and highs 45 to 53. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly cloudy with highs in the 40s. Support comes from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering memberships, educational camps, and habitat projects. More information at mndeerhunters.com. Coming up at 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock tonight, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. Right now, it is time for North Star Stories here on KAXE.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
With headlines from around the state, I'm Zan Holston. White Earth gets federal health accreditation, and cursive makes a comeback. But first, a new effort to investigate and prosecute misconduct by federal immigration agents. The Hennepin County Attorney's Office created what it's calling the Transparency and Accountability Project, an online portal where the public can submit photos, videos, and other documentation related to incidents during Operation Metro Surge. Investigators will review all submissions to evaluate possible unlawful actions by federal agents.
We are actively investigating 17 incidents that have been brought to our attention by the community.
This includes allegations of former Customs and Border Patrol Commander Dan Bovino throwing gas at protesters at a Minneapolis park, and agents tackling and arresting students and teachers at a Minneapolis high school. The office says that charging decisions will take time, given the legal complexities of prosecuting federal agents, but that won't be a deterrent.
We are not afraid of the legal fight.
The State Department is urging all U.S. citizens to leave all countries in the Middle East, saying the conflict may escalate in coming days. More than 250 members of the Minnesota National Guard, including airmen from Duluth's 148th Fighter Wing, are currently deployed in or near the Middle East. National Guard officials say the missions are routine, and so far, no Minnesota service members have been injured. Military actions throughout the Middle East are already affecting gas prices in Minnesota. A AAA gas tracker shows average Minnesota gas prices are already up nearly 14 cents from last week. Lake Country has the highest prices in the state, coming in at just over $3 a gallon, with metro area counties just behind. The lowest averages run the strip of northwestern counties from Wilkin up to Kitson, while Big Stone is the big winner with a lowest average of just $2.54 a gallon. Representative Aaron Cagle is sponsoring a bill to honor the late House Speaker Melissa Hortman. The bill would make Trunk Highway 610, the Hortman Memorial Highway, a roughly 11-mile stretch from I-94 to Highway 10, a project Hortman had long worked on.
This was a really big deal to her. It was a thoroughfare in her community, and it still is one of the river crossings that we use daily. It's a part of our community in the Northern Metro.
The bill now moves to the House Ways and Means Committee. Three counties think the Minnesota Department of Transportation should raise their speed limits on the road from Gully to Grigla. Commissioners in Marshall, Pennington, and Polk counties all passed resolutions that would push the speed limit to 60 miles per hour on county state aid highways 27 and 28, a full 5 miles per hour faster than the current limit. White Earth Nation is the first Minnesota tribe to receive federal health accreditation.
It's a promise to continue improving. It's a promise to remain accountable. It's a promise to honor the trust that the community places in us.
White Earth Nation's public health director, Cindy Rastet, says they're just the ninth tribe nationwide to be recognized for excellence after passing through years of rigorous vetting. Tribal member Gina Boudreaux has worked at the department for 25 years. She says accreditation will help strengthen their programs while keeping services grounded in Anishinaabe culture and community priorities.
Because our people deserve it. They've been through historical trauma, and they deserve the best that we can give them.
North Dakota State University is accepting applications for a summer program focused on Indigenous food systems and public health. The Indigenous Food Sovereignty Emerging Leaders Program runs 3 weeks in June in Fargo, with travel and housing covered and a $3,000 stipend for participants 18 to 24. Applications are open through March 22nd. Details at ndsu.edu. And finally, a question.
Why isn't cursive taught in Minnesota?
The semi-centennial is nearly upon us. That's the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And legislators want your kids to be able to read it in its original form, cursive. A new bill introduced by Senator Ann Rest would mandate teaching students to read and write in loop-de-loop letters by the time they're in fifth grade. There's just one problem.
We might first have to teach the teachers. I'm serious.
The bill will be considered as part of an omnibus later this session. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Scott Detrow. How long do electric vehicle batteries actually last? Back in the early days of the modern EV, there was a real fear that the answer was not that long and that they would need to be replaced midway through owning a car. The good news is those expensive batteries seem to keep going and going. NPR's Camilla Domonoske reports.
That worry that batteries would be short-lived, it wasn't unreasonable. Batteries do age and hold less power. And unlike the little lead-acid starter batteries in gas cars, a giant lithium-ion battery costs thousands of dollars. Norman Hajar, who works for the EV driver's app PlugShare, was an early adopter. He got his Tesla Model S back in 2013, when that landmark vehicle was just redefining what EVs could be. And as for that battery?
I mean, there was really no way of knowing what the future held for it because there was zero track record.
In 2010, the New York Times estimated EV batteries would last, quote, upward from 7 years. Well, Hajar has put nearly 200,000 miles on his Model S, coming on 12 years now on a single battery, and it drives great.
The car was originally rated to have 265 miles of range. It now has around 220, so the amount of degradation is pretty minor.
Today, there's enough data emerging to say good news. Batteries are lasting longer than anybody thought. Now, batteries do sometimes have defects. Hajar actually had his replaced in 2014, very early on, so it's a bit younger than his car. But that kind of bad luck is covered under warranty. As for normal aging, let's look at that data. Adam George works for Cox Automotive, which runs big wholesale auto auctions. He says they'd expected to see batteries really degrade, even in really new cars.
What we have seen, though, is that these 2-, 3-, 4-year-old off-lease cars that are coming back have battery health scores well upwards of 95%, which is solidifying that batteries are standing the test of time.
Cox Automotive has tested nearly 80,000 used EVs of all ages. The average battery health score overall was 92%. That's good. But averages can be misleading. So what about just the oldest cars? Liz Naiman is the director of market insights at Recurrent, a research firm that pulls in data from over 30,000 EV drivers. Now, she warns that the data set of old EVs is pretty small, but based on their community, for EVs a decade old and up, more than 90% are still driving on their original battery.
What we know is that EV batteries are holding up phenomenally well.
Hajar's experience sure looks like the rule, not the exception. Now, why exactly did these batteries last so much longer than expected? Well, one, kudos to the engineers. And two, the way batteries are tested is actually tougher on them than real life. Simona Onori is an associate professor at Stanford University. She says batteries are normally tested by cycling them very quickly from a high state of charge to a low state of charge, all the way up, all the way down.
Whenever you are, you know, on, off, there's lots of stress, right?
But when you're actually driving, you never slam the accelerator to the floor and keep it there until the battery is dead, right? It's a lot more varied.
We accelerate, we decelerate, the battery will be charged and then discharged, some rest if you're at a traffic light.
Stanford found if you test batteries in ways that are more like actual driving, they last a lot longer. Onori says real-world data is now confirming those lab results, that when they're actually driven,
those batteries age gracefully, very gracefully.
Meanwhile, the systems that take care of batteries keep getting better. A lot of new EVs have a different battery chemistry that lasts longer. So we still don't know how long exactly batteries being made now will last. But the new expectation, increasingly, is that they should outlast the cars themselves. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
Support for All Tech Considered comes from the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
Ever wonder why people are so drawn to alcohol? Where does that attraction come from? Science reporter Ari Daniel says perhaps we should look to our primate relatives.
Late last summer, Alexei Morrow was in the Ugandan rainforest collecting chimpanzee urine.
The most consistent, predictable time is in the morning. Just like people, the first thing they do when they wake up is they go pee.
Morrow, a PhD student at UC Berkeley, had a few collection techniques. One involved catching urine droplets from the chimps overhead in a plastic bag stretched over a forked branch. Sharifa Namaganda is a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan who assisted in the field.
You need to make sure that you are not going to be splashed, but plastic bag pee is the best pee you can get, and it is also the sample that will make you most proud.
Because it's not contaminated and can be collected quickly. Each time the team got a sample, Alexei Morrow tested it to see if the chimp had been metabolizing alcohol.
Chimpanzees consume 10 pounds of fruit pulp per day on average. African star apple. It's delicious too. I tried some.
And when fruits like this ripen, they can ferment, producing alcohol.
In primates, it could be that when you smell alcohol, that means that's where the sugars are.
A shortcut for getting more calories, perhaps. Though to be clear, primates aren't likely consuming enough to get drunk. But maybe it's this association with a sugary reward that explains where our attraction to alcohol first originated and why we still gravitate towards it today. Sharifa Namaganda says great apes,
they provide quite useful windows into human evolutionary behavior. And for this project, it's about where love for alcohol might come from.
Previous work showed that many fruits that chimps eat contain a good amount of ethanol, but the team wondered if they were actually consuming it, hence all the urine collection. 17 out of 19 chimps tested positive for ethanol, and at least 10 of those contained a concentration equivalent in humans to having had one or two drinks, says Alexei Morrow. It's too small a number to say anything definitive.
But it is tantalizing that our ancestral diet may have had similar alcohol just baked into our everyday existence.
Perhaps leading to our modern attraction to the stuff, except that today we can produce and consume it at much higher levels. The research appears in the journal Biology Letters. Kat Hobater is a primatologist at the University of St. Andrews who wasn't involved in the study.
This will open up a lot of really exciting new avenues for us to understand both chimpanzee behavior, but potentially some of the evolutionary origins of rituals and social rites of passage that are really important in our own culture, too.
A next step will be to determine whether chimps prefer the fruits containing alcohol. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression. And from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at hewlett.org.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. Lots of local news stories and conversations and music features for you there. And you can click on that donate button to support independent community radio in Northern Minnesota. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region at 5:30. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective with the CBC. And 7 o'clock tonight, John Hennigsgaard is your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, temperatures in the low